Sentire Media.
Hello, you. You're listening to A History of Italy. Episode 168, The Italian Wars, Part 5, Round 1 Aftermath, The South and Center. Lasci i colli nelle valli, tra due salici piangenti. Io ritrovo la speranza di un amore che ormai fu. In this episode, we're going to be taking a fast tour around Italy to see what the situation was after the French invasion of the first round of the Italian Wars. Now, if you wanted to go rushing around Italy to see what things were like in the late 15th century, it would be a very good idea to prepare beforehand, becoming familiar with the local terrain. To do this, you could use our partner for these few episodes, Explore Worldwide. It's all about local knowledge, and that is what sets Explore apart. Their respect for the local culture and environment extend to finding local tour leaders that can get you off the beaten track and into the heart of your adventure, and their small groups allow for a more personalized experience you will never forget. Whether it's visiting a Roman villa on the classical tour in Sicily or a food and wine tasting in the hilltop towns of Tuscany, Explore takes care of everything, putting the quality of their local tour leaders front and center, so you'll truly understand the wow factor of where you are. Whatever you decide to do and however you decide to travel, don't just travel, explore. Go to exploreworldwide.com for more info. That's exploreworldwide.com for more info, or better, follow the link in the show notes. So we've just had a rather traumatic visit from French King Charles VIII, who has come down to lay his ancestral claim to the Kingdom of Naples. He has managed to come down, take the kingdom, leave, get caught up in the Battle of Fornovo as he left, and then we saw that the previous King of Naples, Ferrandino, thanks to the support of the Spanish, managed to waltz right back in and take it back. On the surface, it seemed that the only real change that had come about on the Italian peninsula due to the descent of the French king was the fact that the Medici were no longer in control in Florence. Having in part spent a lot of time concentrating on different areas for one or more episodes, I thought we would take a time out to make sure we know exactly what the unchanged situation was before it changes completely. This is a bit different from our usual recap episodes, as it is more a case of bringing all areas up to the same timeline so they're all on the same page and more or less ready for a second round of Italian Wars. Our reference point is a pretty good map that you can see in the show notes or on social media of Italy in 1492, at the time of the death of Lorenzo the Magnificent. So as always, we start with Sardinia. We don't really have a lot to say about Sardinia, except for the fact that it was directly part of the Kingdom of Spain, nothing of huge note going on at the time, and the same goes for the next island along, Sicily. We spent most of our time actually talking about the Kingdom of Naples, so we don't have too much to add there. Just a reminder that Ferrandino got his kingdom back by 1495 and under control by the following year, then felt he had done enough and died, and then was succeeded by his uncle Frederick or Federico, since the previous king had left no heir. The King of Spain, another Ferdinand, had made some grumblings about the fact that his claim to the kingdom was stronger, but he let things pass for now. One lasting thing that the French did bring and leave in Italy was a nice little souvenir of their presence, the sexually transmitted disease known as syphilis. Interestingly, it was known at the time in Latin as Malum Gallicum, Latin still being the language of some correspondence and record keeping, or Mal Francese in Italian, the French malady, believing it had been brought by the French army. The French, on the other hand, believed that they had picked it up in Naples and called it the Mal Napolitain, the Neapolitan malady. It seems the Neapolitans were right. Syphilis was originally supposed to have been brought to Europe by the crew of Christopher Columbus, who had picked it up from the native women of the New World. The long incubation period of the disease meant that it only really started to come out during the Neapolitan campaign, leading the French to think they had picked it up there, rather than bringing it with the army and the groups of prostitutes who followed the army, as they did in most cases at that time. The fact that the disease had symptoms similar to smallpox meant that it was often confused with that disease. We mentioned that at the start of his campaign, Charles himself had got sick, and some think that might have been syphilis, possibly from a group of high-class Milanese escorts that the Duchess Beatrice of Milan had brought for the king's entertainment. The disease became incredibly widespread, affecting all levels of society without distinction. Famously, as we'll see, Cesare Borgia seems to have been affected by it, causing him to have to wear a mask at times when it flared up. Obviously, one of the first groups to be unjustly blamed for the spread were the Jewish community, particularly those who were escaping persecution in the super-Catholic Spain and heading for Naples. The first written description of the disease in Italy came at around the time of the Battle of Fornovo. What a nice little gift to leave your host country. Our next stop on the tour heading north would be the Papal States, and at this time, that meant the Borgias. We saw that in 1497, after Charles of France had left, but before he died, Giovanni Borgia, Cesare and Lucrezia's brother, had been murdered. Some suspect by Cesare himself, even though Giovanni had had a long list of enemies to choose from. Lucrezia evidently thought that her father and brother were involved because she went ballistic, and in an unusual display of defiance, she berated her father, who actually fainted. This was not rare, as Alexander VI was more than once affected by fainting spells, including on the day of his coronation. This was despite his robust yet not unhealthy condition. He liked very much to indulge in pleasures of the flesh, but he was not, for example, a heavy drinker. He had quick mood changes, and anger was one of the quickest to reach. More than once, people around him would have to intervene to separate him from someone he was about to come to blows with. All in all, however, you don't get the idea of Rodrigo Borgia, Pope Alexander VI, being a nasty guy, but rather someone you would enjoy partying with, if you enjoy extreme partying, of course. His son, Cesare, was something different. Now, of course, considering all the people who had reason to hate him, including the next pope, it's hard to separate fact from fiction. But if even a small percentage of the things said about him is true, for example, even by one of his fanboys, such as Niccolò Machiavelli, it makes for a rather ruthless character. He loved to party like his dad and would attend some of the Pope's lavish parties in the Vatican that were likely to have included orgies. But Cesare also liked roaming the dark streets of Rome at night and going to low-level taverns, looking for fun and often a fight. It is said that he would enter a tavern in disguise to see if anyone was bad-mouthing him or his family. If he didn't hear anything, he would start himself to see if anyone took the bait. If some poor, unsuspecting fool did have something to say about the Borgias, he would then be asked to go outside so they could talk away from prying ears. Then that person would disappear, maybe to be fished out of the Tiber River sometime later. Once, the story goes, when a man criticized him, Cesare cut off his hand, half of his tongue, attached the half-tongue to the hand, and then put it on public display as an example to others. One of the taverns he was a patron of was also the territory of a well-known prostitute known as La Vespa, the Wasp, since she was suspected of having murdered some of her lovers. She repented later in life and became a well-loved and charitable figure, using the wealth she had accumulated to help younger girls. One evening, La Vespa had her daughter with her, and a drunken man started to approach the young girl. When she refused him, he got aggressive, and then was confronted by a smaller masked man. Before the rowdy patron knew what had happened, he was lying dead on the floor, with a dagger in his heart. The dagger left by the assailant was later revealed to bear the initials of Cesare Borgia. Once the landlord had discovered the presence of this illustrious guest, he threw a big party for him and all those present. You will remember that Cesare Borgia, for a lot of these adventures, was still a cardinal, but the ecclesiastical career was not what he wanted, and in 1498 he decided to leave the cardinalate. The other cardinals did not really dare to do much more than grumble. Now it was time to set about building a political legacy. The first step there was to go and have a hobnob, as in the conversation, not the biscuit, with the new King of France after the accidental death of Charles VIII, the former king's cousin, the Duke of Orléans. Cesare took with him two very big bargaining chips. One was a brand new cardinal's hat for a relative of the king, and that was the lesser one. The other was a letter that contained the Pope's permission for Louis to repudiate his current wife, have his marriage officially annulled, leaving him free to marry his predecessor's widow, Anne of Brittany. This so that he could secure those lands, meaning Brittany, to the crown. The Pope had told Cesare not to give up those chips too easily, but he need not have given that suggestion. Cesare milked that cow for everything it was worth. He came home a Duke of Valentinois, an area between Provence and Burgundy. For that reason, he is also known in Italy as Il Valentino, which is also the pseudonym of one of our wonderful Patreon supporters, James C. Hello, James. Then he got himself a wife. That is Cesare Borgia, not James. The first two candidates, including a possible bride of royal blood, Charlotte, had already heard about their potential future husband and wanted absolutely nothing to do with him. The third, Charlotte d'Aubray, knew very well who he was, but wasn't really bothered, and so she was the one. The title and wife were, of course, important, but it wasn't much in Italy without land, and that was the other thing Cesare brought home. The promise that the king would support him in his ambition to carve out a duchy for himself in central Italy. Things were now in motion. The scene was set. Now, to set up a duchy, there was not a very wide range of choices of places to start on the Italian peninsula. The best thing was to carve something out of what was officially the Papal States, with the excuse of bringing the independently minded dukes and counts and marquesses and so on under heel. This meant following the example in part of the nephew of Pope Sixtus IV, he of Pazzi conspiracy fame, Girolamo Riario, an aim for the Romagna area. Indeed, Riario's widow, one Caterina Sforza, was holding the cities of Forlì and Imola. Riario himself had been assassinated in 1488. Then, starting down in the Marche region, where there were the Montefeltro in Urbino, a branch of the Sforza in Pesaro, the Malatesta in Rimini, the Bentivoglio in the fiercely independent Bologna, all the way up to the holdings of the Este, which were outside and so marked the border of the northern Papal States. You can see all of these on the map I mentioned. Then, of course, north of the Estense domains, squashed between them, the Duchy of Milan and the Republic of Venice, we had the lands of the hero of the Battle of Fornovo, Francesco Gonzaga II, Marquis of Mantua. We're going there for a visit after the next episode, in which instead we'll be finishing this brief tour. In the meantime, thank you very, very much for listening. A History of Italy is a Sentire Media production created and hosted by me, Mike Corradi, and produced by my wonderful Patreon supporters. Starting with the first part of the Margherita Hack and Galileo Galilei level, and they are Alison H, Amanda D, Annie, Anthony G, Carsten M, Catherine C, C Lane, Cindy M, DB, Dean V, Demetrio M, Dennis S, Dominique T, Emily B, Eric W, Alam, Federica, Gabriel, Greg, Gunnar, Ignazio, and of course, Il Valentino. And we can't forget the tippy-top Maria Montessori and Dante Alighieri level. Lisa K, Andrew M, Peter W, David L, David C, JW, Sen, David A, Karen D, Peter F, Helenka, Kaiser Bosch, Bridget, Dallas, and Joseph. Thank you. Thank you, one and all. If, like them, you would like to have access to ad-free, that's including free from host read ads, episodes, you can become a Patreon supporter for as little as $1 a month. Go to ahistoryofitaly.com to the support page and click through to the Patreon website. On the A History of Italy website, you'll also find timelines and reading sources if you want to know more about any of the topics we talk about. Thanks again very much for listening, and until next time, arrivederci.